Sabbath greetings to you all. 2 Timothy 3:16 says that the Bible, that all scripture is profitable for reproof, correction, for doctrine, and for instruction in righteousness. And I want to make it clear right from the outset that the purpose of this sermon is instruction in righteousness, not reproof and correction. And I was going to talk about this topic and several others in the sermon. And as I began to study it, I realized that the single topic is one sermon all in itself, because the Bible is packed with instruction about the topic about which I will speak today. Now, I've been talking for several sermons about the wiles of the devil and the armor of God. And so this is another sermon in that series where Paul commands us to stand. So I want to rehearse a little bit of history. You remember that in World War II, the Allies invaded the beaches of Normandy in June of 1944. They began to push the Germans back. By December 1944, the German army had been pushed back to its own borders, several hundred miles, by the advancing Allied forces. And they realized that soon their own nation was going to be invaded, so they planned a counterattack. This is in December 1944. They sent 30 divisions of armor and infantry toward the British and American forces, and their plan was to split these forces, to divide them, and then encircle them and destroy them. The attack was expected, counterattack at this point was expected by the Allies, but the point of attack, the location of the attack, and the timing were unknown. So in the middle of December, the Germans did attack. The point of attack was a complete surprise. And it caused a retreat of the Allied forces on a broad front extending in the north from Luxembourg and Belgium all the way down through France. And the Germans pushed the American lines back. And this retreat of the Allied forces caused a concave bulge in the American lines. And it gave the Battle of the Bulge, December 1944, its name. A small town in Belgium was critical to the success of the German plan. Since this little town called Bastogne was an important crossroad, several hardtop paved highways went through Bastogne. And in order to be able to move troops and supplies up to the front, the capture of this little town, Bastogne, was critical to the German success. Because the Germans were low on fuel, they were low on resources. The Allies had been bombing their refineries at a little town called Ploiești in Romania, and they were low on fuel, and they had one chance left to salvage the war. In order to execute their battle plan, they had to sweep through Belgium and quickly capture this town, Bastogne, overcome all defending forces, and take control of the important bridges and roads. So the Germans surrounded and besieged Bastogne on December 21st. This town was being defended by the 101st Airborne and the 10th Armored Divisions. Their situation was critical. Most of their medical supplies and most of their medics had been captured by the Germans. Food and ammunition were in very short supply. At the beginning of the siege, there were only 10 rounds of ammunition for every soldier. But over the next several days, the weather improved, allowing Bastogne to be resupplied by airdrops. And eventually, the defenders of Bastogne were able to repel several German attempts to break through their lines. But at one point, German General von Leutwitz demanded an American surrender. He told them their position was untenable and that they were going to lose. And the commander of the 101st Airborne Division, General Anthony McAuliffe, sent the Germans a one-word reply. Does anyone remember what his reply was to the demand for surrender? Nuts. This bold refusal to surrender And the manner in which the refusal was delivered raised the morale and inspired the 101st and the 10th Armored Division to stand and defend its position. The besieging forces of the Germans were by this point exhausted, and they were running short of fuel, food, and supplies. All their tanks were destroyed, and the siege was broken. By December 26, George Patton's 4th Armored Division, coming up from France, driving north, broke through German lines, relieved the defenders. The attack failed, and by February, the Allies had regained all the ground lost in the Battle of the Bulge. The determination of General McAuliffe and his soldiers to defend their position was key to the Allied victory in this pivotal battle. If Bastogne had fallen to the Germans, they might have been able to push the Allies farther back into France. This would cause the war to be extended and increase the casualty count on both sides. So in recent sermons, we've explored the methods of our adversary, the devil. We've read Paul's admonition. Let's turn there to Ephesians 6:10 about withstanding him. We've read this in each of the sermons, but let's read it again, because each time we've concentrated on something different. Paul says in Ephesians 6:10, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles, the strategy, the tactics, the dirty tricks of the devil." He says, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and against the rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand, stand therefore, having your loins girt about with the truth, so on and so forth. And he goes into the explanation about the armor of God. But he tells us to stand and to withstand. The Greek word, as I've said before, for stand is a military term that means to stand in place and defend a position. It describes a situation like the one faced by the American soldiers at Bastogne. And in verse 13, the word withstand means to oppose. We are to defend our position. We are to oppose the adversary. We are supposed to be an impediment to his progress. We are to understand and withstand his stratagems. We are to oppose his ways. So in the next couple sermons, I'd like to explore what our position is. What is the position we are supposed to defend? What is the ground we are supposed to stand on and not relinquish? What is it we're supposed to defend without retreating? Well, let's talk about the devil. As I was talking to you in the last sermon, something I had forgotten came to my mind, and I had to go back and check it out to make sure it was true. But the name devil, does anyone know what the word devil means? The word devil means slanderer. So let's turn over to Revelation 12 and verse 10. Because Satan constantly accuses and slanders the people of God. Revelation 12, verse 10. "I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, 'Now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God night and day.'" So think about this now. Is God going to be swayed by accusations against us that are not true? Would the accuser need to fabricate lies to accuse us? God would know a lie from the truth and would be able to dismiss him very easily. But don't we give Satan plenty of opportunity to accuse us truly? I think that many times when Satan accuses us to God, he's speaking the truth about us. We sin, we have problems, we have faults, we make mistakes. So perhaps much of the time when he's accusing us, he's speaking the truth. Yet, he is called the slanderer. Slander is not necessarily falsehood. Listen to the Holman Illustrated Bible definition of slander. This is from the Holman Bible Dictionary. It says, slander is to speak critically of another person with the intent to hurt. The New Bible Dictionary says, evil speaking may be defined as slander, misrepresentation, defamation, or deceit. This may be done by spreading false reports or by reporting truth maliciously, that is, talebearing, gossiping. In Leviticus, God had warned Israel about gossiping, about talebearing. Let's turn to Leviticus 19, verse 16. As I said, this is not to be considered as reproof and correction. This sermon is about instruction in righteousness and a warning. Leviticus 19, verse 16, you shall not go up and down as a talebearer among your people. Neither shall you stand against the blood of your neighbor. I am the Lord. So if we speak of anyone in an uncomplimentary fashion, we're committing slander. In Titus 3 and verse 1, Paul said, remind them to be submissive to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good work, and to speak evil of no one. Avoid quarreling, be gentle, show perfect courtesy toward all people. Now, Benjamin Franklin, I guess inspired by this verse, had said, I will speak ill of no man, not even in the matter of truth. So Franklin said he wasn't going to speak ill of anyone, even if he was speaking the truth. But rather, he said, excuse the faults I hear, and upon proper occasions, speak all the good I know of everybody. This is a Christian principle. This is a virtue. Speaking evil, whether in error or whether speaking in lies or in truth, speaking evil of another person is an aggressive act. But we don't think of it this way. But it is an attack against the person. It's an act of violence, as surely as a punch in the face or a blow to the belly with a sword. Proverbs explains this. Let's turn to Proverbs 26 and verse 22. The words of a talebearer are like wounds. They go down into the innermost parts of the belly. So speaking evil of another person is just as deadly as thrusting him through with a sword. Have you ever discovered that someone you knew had spoken evil of you? I discovered once, I was shocked, and I guess for a long time I just couldn't believe it, a guy that I thought was my friend, a Christian, slandered me. He made up an accusation about me, and he told it to the minister. He told the minister that I was a weak member who had doubted the very existence of God. And this came back to me because the minister repeated it to others. So I confronted the man, and he denied it, and I was stunned. I didn't know how to respond. Should I have been angry? I don't know. It was surreal. It was unbelievable, and I really couldn't comprehend it. But has this happened to any of you? Have you been slandered? Has someone spoken maliciously about you? If it happened, perhaps you were hurt, you were offended, you were grieved, you felt stress. You felt pain because your reputation had been sullied. And once your reputation is bad, it's hard to get it back. Being a victim of this kind of attack is painful. It's been known to cause death. Here's an example from a book called The Encyclopedia of 77,000 Illustrations. Here's a man who was killed by a false accusation. The family of a man wrongly accused of shoplifting was awarded $107,000 by a jury, which was convinced that his death at age 53 was caused by a broken heart. This is in 1975, so this is almost 40 years ago. The episode leading to the 1975 judgment issued by the Sacramento Superior Court began with a 63-cent can of Danish bacon. Charged with shoplifting the bacon in a drugstore was John F. Abercrombie, a retired Air Force colonel with a distinguished World War II combat record and post-war assignments. that involved top security clearance. Abercrombie, also an assistant scoutmaster, was employed as a civilian analyst by the California Highway Patrol. A municipal court found him innocent of the shoplifting charges, but friends testified that after the accusation, he was a changed man. They said he lost his zest for life, he became depressed, and finally, he died from a fatal heart condition. And a jury was convinced that this death was the result of a false accusation. So false accusation can be a deep wound, very grievous. None of us would consider striking another person in the face or thrusting him through with the sword, but sometimes we have no compunction about inflicting a deep and festering wound by being a talebearer or an accuser. Evil speaking is designed to wound and kill. This is one of Satan's tactics. And remember, we talked about Satan's tactics, which were deception, diversion, division, camouflage, attacking weaknesses, and striking from ambush. Remember, that was in two sermons ago. One of Satan's tactics is to strike suddenly, unexpectedly, from an ambush. Proverbs 12:6 talks about the kind of attack that arises from an accusation. Proverbs 12:6. The wounds of the wicked are to lie in wait for blood, but the mouth of the upright shall deliver them. So to speak evil of someone is to ambush from behind cover. It's wicked to attack someone verbally. There are people who would never contemplate an act of violence, but they have fewer reservations about lying in wait for blood in this manner. It's usually done in secret from behind cover. Remember, we talked about the Union forces that were traveling up a hill, marching up a hill at Cross Keys in Virginia, the Battle of Cross Keys in 1862. And they were foolish enough to be advancing up the road without skirmishers up in advance, without point men. And the rebels were lying in wait for them, hidden behind a fence. So this kind of an attack is usually done secretly. It's a cowardly act. The perpetrators don't want the victim to know what they have done. Let's turn over to Psalm 62, because David had this problem, and he complained to God about it and asked for God for protection. Psalm 64, let's go there. Psalm 64, verse 2. David says, "Hide me from the secret counsel of the wicked, from the insurrection of the workers of iniquity, who whet their tongue like a sword and bend their bows to shoot their arrows, even bitter words, that they may shoot in secret at the perfect. Suddenly do they shoot at him." They've ambushed him. They've come out from behind a tree or a rock and fear not. Of course they don't fear. They're not exposed. They encourage themselves in an evil matter. They commune of laying snares secretly, saying, "Who can see me?" So slander, remember, one of the strategies of the devil is division. Slander is divisive. And I read a book called, or I read an excerpt from a book called The Power of Words. The article was called The Power of Words, in a book called Connect the Testaments by John Barry. And he was talking about evil speaking and slander and how it is divisive. And he says, "Gossip kills churches. And gossip is always painful, especially when disguised as concern. A request to, quote, pray for so-and-so because of this thing he did is not asking for prayers, it's gossiping. If you know some personal detail about someone's mishap," he says, "don't share it with everyone, take it to God." So slander is kind of one way that Satan divides people. And division is one of his tactics. And he'd like us all to be spreading tales, true or false, about each other. Let's turn over to James 4, verse 11. Another aspect of being critical, speaking evil, of slandering someone else. James 4, verse 11. James says, "Do not speak evil against one another, brothers. The one who speaks against a brother judges his brother, speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. Now, he says there is only one lawgiver and judge, he who is able to save and destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? So who is that? Who is that one person who is the judge? It's God, right? When we're critical of another, we have judged his behavior or his motives or his character. We have determined somehow that we are worthy to be a judge and to evaluate this person. We ignore the fact that we have the same flaws, the same problems, or even worse. And worst of all, I think, we appropriate the role and the responsibility of God, who is the only true judge and lawgiver. And it seems to me that if we do this, if we have set ourselves up as the judge in God's place, we have decided that we will be like the Most High, haven't we? Who else said that? I will be like the Most High. Satan said that. So when we take the responsibility to be the judge of another person, we have usurped God's role and his responsibility. Whose motive was that? That was Satan's motive. If we do that, are we not following Satan's agenda? God doesn't correct every sin immediately. He talks about this in Psalm 50 in verse 20 and seems to be a little bit vexed that people take advantage of his forbearance and his patience. He's talking about people who speak against their own brothers in Psalm 50, verse 20. He said, "You sit and speak against your brother. You slander your own mother's son. These things you have done, and I kept silence, and you thought that I was altogether such a one as yourself." But he won't let this go on forever. Just because he remained silent for a time, he said, "I will reprove you, and I will set them in order before your eyes." So God doesn't always render justice immediately for every word that escapes our lips. And because we hadn't been corrected, if we are critical or we speak evil of someone else, we shouldn't think that God condones slander or that he is on the same page with us when we do it, because eventually God will reprove and correct us for our errors. And God is saying to us in this verse that we should not construe God's silence as approval. We have to realize that God is very patient in justice. He was willing to wait a long time, but eventually he will execute justice. He explains this in Psalm 101, verse 5. He says, "Whoever slanders his neighbor secretly, I will destroy. He who has a haughty look and an arrogant heart, I will not endure." So when we stand against Satan, we need to, one of the places that we're defending is the place where we will not speak evil of another person. But the devil would like to enlist us in his slanderous endeavors. He tempts us to say things about each other. Perhaps you have, I had an experience recently where I was engaged in a conversation and a person's name came up in the conversation. And I was immediately tempted to say something critical about the person just because his name popped up. And I was I had to fight back the urge to blurt something out. Have you ever blurted something out and wish you hadn't said it later? Who besides me has done that? Anyone? Well, this time I was able to keep my mouth shut. The devil would like to enlist us in his slanderous endeavors. When Revelation says that Satan accuses the saints day and night, does it mean that all the accusations and all the slander and all the criticism, does that all come from his lips? Or does some of it come from ours? Do our lips ever become those of the slanderer himself? If that happens, don't we become his agents? We've been told to stand against him, to oppose him, and not to retreat. But if we do the things that he does, He's won. And not only has he pushed us off the ground that we're supposed to defend, he's made us turncoat and follow him rather than following God. He's enlisted us in his army. So we must resist the urge to attack someone with our words. Resist the urge to speak evil of others. And, of course, when someone's speaking evil, someone's listening, right? We shouldn't even listen when someone is speaking evil of another person. Listening is at least half as bad as speaking evil. If you listen to malicious talk or hurtful speech or gossip or rumor, you're participating in evil. When we do that, we're consenting to the act. But there's another problem. If you learn something evil about someone else, now you know it. You will need to ensure that you don't repeat it. Why burden yourself with a potential sin? If you learn something about someone, some juicy morsel, now it's up to you to resist the temptation to spread that to somebody else. Why burden yourself with that? A modern proverb says, a gossiper knows where to take his garbage. Avoid making your ears someone else's garbage can. So what do you do if you're involved in a conversation that turns into criticism or an attack or an evil a session of evil speaking or gossip about someone else? If you can't do anything else, walk away from the conversation. Change the subject or say, I don't care to hear about that. Or perhaps you should defend the victim in some cases. In other cases, it might just cause an accident. Not an accident, but an argument. So you have to be wise about that. Can you remind the speaker that he's doing something evil? Can you respond to every negative statement with something that's positive? We need to fight back in a Christian way against evil speech, criticism, slander about our brethren. And if we have something that we want to say about another person, where do we say that? To whom do we say that? Here's the answer, Proverbs 25 and verse 9. If you have a contention with somebody, if you have a beef with somebody, if you know something about somebody and you think something needs to be said about it, here's what you do. Proverbs 25, verse 9. Debate your cause with your neighbor himself. And discover, don't reveal a secret to another, lest he hears it and put you to shame, and your infamy turn not away. So this is the correct approach. When we have something to say about another person, it should be said to his face. If that can't be done, it's not worth saying. It shouldn't be said. Another aspect of standing in our position is a biblical example. You can turn to the first chapter of James. The biblical principle is, be slow to speak. There's sometimes an impulse to speak abruptly. An idea or a thought passionately comes to our minds and demands immediate expression in conversation. And the Bible tells us we must quell these impulses and evaluate what we're about to say before we say it. James 1 and verse 19, he says, wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, be eager to hear things, to learn, but he says, slow to speak. Don't say everything that comes to your mind right away. Slow to wrath. I guess that bears repeating. Let every man be swift to hear, but slow to speak. Mastering this principle is a giant step in overcoming the impulse to slander, in saying things we will regret later, a giant step in overcoming foot-and-mouth disease. I heard a minister one time say something very useful that I've tried to remember. So I want to pass it along to you. When you feel the impulse to say something, be slow to speak and ask yourself Three questions. Evaluate what you're about to say and say to yourself, does this need to be said? Does it need to be said? Does it need to be said now? And most importantly, am I the person who ought to say it? So, one biblical principle to help us in standing our ground against the devil in his agenda to have us slander each other is be slow to speak. Another one is to speak less. I once heard a talk show host apologize. I was listening to the news, and apparently someone, I think it was Oprah Winfrey, I'm not sure, I forget, had said something on her TV show that was wrong or that was offensive or hurtful, and she had to make a special appearance on the news and apologize for what she had said. But in her apology, and I kind of commiserated with her, she says, it's difficult to talk for 5 hours every week, to produce a stream of verbiage for 5 hours every week and not say something ever that's wrong or offensive. This is a biblical principle. It's found in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Let's turn over there. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 2. This goes along with being slow to speak. Solomon says, don't be rash with your mouth, and don't let your heart be hasty to utter anything. For God is in heaven and you're on the earth. Therefore, he says, let your words be few. Now, most automobile accidents are rear-end collisions. Statistically, most of the time, most of the accidents that occur because somebody ran into the guy in front of him. I was on my way to work a year ago, and it was about this time of year, and it was still dark in the mornings before about 6:30, and it was evident that traffic was really slow, and there was an accident up ahead of us, and I'm on a six-lane highway, Route 7, going from Leesburg down towards Sterling, down toward Tyson's Corner. And finally, we got to the point where the accident had occurred, and there were four cars involved in a collision. And each car's bumper, front bumper, was under the rear bumper of the car in front of it. And one car actually had both the front and the rear jacked up so that its wheels weren't even touching the ground any longer. And this happened right in front of a stoplight, and it was apparent that what had happened was everybody was following too closely, and they were going too fast, and the light turned red, and the first car in this line of four cars decided he had to slam on the brakes and not go through the stoplight, and the four cars in back of them all slammed on their brakes, and the noses went down, and each one of them scooped up under the car in front of it. Well, most accidents are rear-end collisions. One principle I try to apply as I drive to work in the dark is I try to stay a reasonable distance back of the cars in front of me. The farther you are from the car in front of you, the less likely, just statistically, the less likely you are to run into the guy. In like manner, the fewer words you say, the fewer words you speak, the less likely it is that we will say something that's sin. We all need to develop the habit, perhaps, of speaking less. Because the faculty of speech is to be used to edify. It was designed to build up. Paul talks about this in Ephesians. He says, this is Ephesians 4, verse 29. He says, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such is as good for building up, for edifying, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. So we have to consider whether the things that we were saying are building someone up or are they tearing someone down? Are they actually even tearing down the people that we're talking to by burdening them with the knowledge of something they really don't need to know? Hearing an evil report about someone does no one any good. It's a burden to bear. It gives the potential for additional sin. The power of speech is a wonderful privilege that must not be misused. Our speech should be used to edify, to build. Too often, we use our words to tear down, and I think we've all been guilty of it. And Solomon says in Proverbs 20 and verse 15, he says, There is gold and a multitude of rubies, but the lips of knowledge are a precious jewel. Good speech, speech that builds up, is precious, more than gold and silver, more than jewels. The faculty of speech has enormous potential to be a blessing to others. But we need to make a conscious effort to speak only well of others. We are supposed to esteem all others better than ourselves. We're supposed to love our enemies. When we are tempted to speak evil, perhaps while we're thinking about the thing that we've said and considering it, we should just think for a while about trying to find something good to say about the person that we just intended to malign. In the interim, while we're thinking and hoping that we come up with something, there won't be any uttering of slander. So our adversary, the devil, our enemy, is named descriptively and accurately. He is an accuser and a slanderer. And he uses his slanderous words in secret to ambush, to divide us, to make us hate one another. He takes every opportunity to enlist us in his efforts. And I thought, sometimes people are so intent on speaking evil about each other that I can well imagine Satan just lying in a hammock with his arms behind his head and his feet crossed, thinking, they're doing my work for me. I don't need to work so hard. So we need to think about that. Get that picture in your mind. Satan doesn't have to work hard if we're doing his work for him. He takes every opportunity to enlist us in his efforts to malign and slander. Not only does he want us to relinquish our position, he wants to recruit us and have us defect to his side. When he does this, he's attacking the ground that we stand on, the ground we're supposed to defend. We need to take heart to Paul's admonition to oppose and stand against him, not to join him. As General McAuliffe at Boulogne, we must not relinquish our position. We do this by eliminating hurtful speech, slander, criticism, any words that are hurtful to others.